First paper is from PD Dr. Eva Bischoff from the University of Trier. She is working in the International History Department, and her research focus is on the history of Australia and New Zealand, the history of racism, gender and body history, global history, colonial history with a focus on Great Britain, Germany and the US, post-colonial studies, queer studies and settler colonial studies. Today she is going to speak about the Ocean of Dreams. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for this introduction. Thank you. I came to international history and women's history through the Department of North American History at the University of Cologne. I was unfamiliar with the academic environment. My father was a captain on a ship going up and down the rivers in Europe, mostly the Rhine, sometimes the Mosel, sometimes the Main. So when, as a child, we traveled with him from time to time. And I wouldn't need this microphone because my voice carries. I can do this, but we use the microphone for the recording, obviously. My mom was a homemaker, as they were at that point in time, and I wasn't very familiar with the academic environment, but I knew that kneeling in front of a bookcase with a staircase going up to the next level and all the dirt from the other students' shoes falling on your head was not a way to study. This was the two shelves of women's history in the regular history department at the University of Cologne when I started to study. So I knelt there looking at women's history. And then I found out that there was a department for North American history where there were whole bookshelves for women's and other people's histories. And you could stand up. You didn't have to kneel. So I ended up studying a lot of North American history, which is why my interest is kind of a bit broader maybe than for other people. And I have a tendency to claim that I'm doing global history because it's the easiest way to explain that I'm interested in a lot of things. So what I'm going to do today is, first of all, to thank Bettina for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to learn from all of you, especially from our guests from Aotearoa, New Zealand. Very grateful to be able to be here. And I would like to begin my presentation with an acknowledgement and a cultural warning. I've been invited to talk about German colonial history in the Pacific. It's mostly a colonizer's history, and the notion of the Pacific and its equivalents in European languages, such as Mar del Sur or Grand Ocean or South Seas or the Südsee in German, is or are, of course, Euro-American imperialist constructs. To the colonizers, the Pacific was an object of colonial knowledge, but also a social, political, and economic space of exchange and violence, of migration and settlement, of sexual fantasies and scientific endeavors, of trade and resource exploitation, hunting whales or seals or collecting guano as fertilizer. It disregards indigenous agency and spatial concepts, as Greg Denning and Epili Haufa have pointed out. Both scholars have urged us to focus on the continuous presence of Pacific Islanders and their role in creating what Haufa called the Sea of Islands, and Denning coined the term Oceania for that. And it is this sovereignty and agency of Pacific Islanders I would like to stress and acknowledge at the beginning of my presentation. Due to my brief, so to speak, this will fall short in the rest of my presentation. I'm very much aware of that. But I only have 20 minutes. And since the Pacific history isn't, so colonial history hasn't been taught in German schools for a long time, and the Pacific history of that part is falling short altogether, so I had to make choices. I will speak about German colonial aspirations and practices. As I said, as German colonialism was violent and driven by greed and racism, this is reflected in historical language and images. As historians, we have to face these and we have to analyze them. However, these words and depictions do harm until today, and I will therefore avoid historical racist language and imagery the best I can, and only show or cite what is necessary for my argument. So, the Ocean of Dreams, the German colonialism and the Pacific. I chose this title because I'm convinced of two things. First, from the late 18th century onward, German-speaking people imagined what they called the Südsee, on the one hand, as a utopian paradise, and Pacific Islanders as children of nature, especially true for Tahiti or Samoa, for instance. And on the other hand, they imagined it as a forsaken prehistoric space populated by so-called savages, and emblematic for that is the image of Papua New Guinea, until today, actually. And this phantasmagorical mode is a general characteristic of German colonialism prior, throughout, and after colonialism proper, meaning the period of colonial political rule between 1884 and 1919. However, the Pacific was more than an imagined space. In a very real way, it was a training ground for German colonists. Secondly, until very recently, as I mentioned, historians describe German colonial rule in the Pacific, if discussed at all, as mostly peaceful and benign. In contrast to African colonial history, violence and exploitation were considered the exception in these parts of German colonies. As a result, for a long time, this part of German colonial history was left mostly untouched by recent debates about the history and legacy of German colonialism. I would like to discuss both aspects in two sections of my presentation, one looking at the history of German colonialism in the Pacific, and the other presenting recent research results. The latter will be a bit shorter than the first one. So, history. Germans came to the Pacific just like every other European. They came as whalers. This is the ship Europa, owned by a Bremen company. During the 1820s and 1830s, ships from the northern German ports of Bremen and Oldenburg set out to participate in the whaling industry in the Pacific and trained as so many Euro-American fleets in the North Atlantic, in the German case mostly in Greenland. They expanded into the Pacific as the Atlantic whale populations shrank here due to overhunting. And you will find memorials of that in parts of German towns until today. This is Bremen, it's a city up north, part of the city called Bremen-Fegesack, that's a part of the city. And what you can see here is a bronze memorial that's actually built after the image of a real bone, whale bone memorial. This one has been erected in 1987. This is bronze, but the original used to be real whale bone and was deconstructed at that earlier. So this memory, in a way, is alive, but it's, of course, very idealized in a way. Germans also came as missionaries. Among the first to arrive was Carl Sylvius Völkner. Völkner was born in Kassel, probably in 1819. We don't have proper records for that, but he trained at the missionary college at Hamburg, which is another big port city up north. And Völkner was one of several missionaries sent to Aotearoa, New Zealand, by the Norddeutsche Mission, the North German Missionary Society in English. He arrived in August 1849 and worked initially with another German missionary in Taranaki. In 1822, he offered his services to the Church Missionary Society, and those familiar with Aotearoa's history know that this is a British missionary society. He took charge of the CMS mission station at Opotiki in August 1861. There, he worked with the support of the Te Whakatoeha, and I really pray that I pronounced that correctly. And with their support and guidance, he established a church in Opotiki in the Auckland province, present-day Bay of Plenty. And this is why I think it's of particular interest to our guests here today. Faulkner's significance lies not so much in his life as a missionary, but in his death at the hands of members of his own congregation in March 1865. And we heard about this earlier. The 60s is the period of this fierce, violent struggle. He was accused by his community, or parts of the members of his community accused him of spying for the British, for the Crown, which was actually true. He wrote reports to the governor, and he was hanged for that. But George Grey, the governor at that point in time, didn't take that well. And in response to Faulkner's death, he authorized a military expedition to arrest what he would call the perpetrators. And in September 1865, Opotiki was taken by British forces, and quite a number of people were killed. Reports differ between 16 and 58. The PAR was razed to the ground, and in following 85,000 hectares of Maori land was taken, was confiscated in response to this death. And I'm very sorry to say that, but this is a part of German Maori relations that's completely forgotten in Germany, at least. It's certainly remembered in New Zealand, I would expect, but not in Germany. I learned about this while preparing this talk. More clearly remembered, at least some of them, are German scientists who came to the Pacific. The most prominent among them is Georg Forster, the son of Johann Reinhold Forster, and this is both of them in this image. Georg accompanied his father on board the Resolution, that's James Cook's flagship, during the Navigator's second voyage, not the first we just heard about. Reinhold, the father, recommended by Joseph Banks, which is kind of the naturalist at that point in time in Britain. Reinhold served as the exhibition's naturalist, so scientist, everything between botany and medicine and ethnology. His son acted as his assistant, collecting, preserving, drawing, and taking notes. His travel account, first published in English in 1777 and then in German, 78 to 80 in installments, established Georg Forster as an expert on the in German Südsee and his peoples. According to literary scholars, the publication of, in German, Reise um die Welt, Voyage Around the World, marks even the beginning of German-speaking travel literature as a genre. So this is a landmark, so to speak. The study impressed many of Georg's contemporaries, among them Alexander von Humboldt, with whom he would later travel through Europe. And it was also an important stepping stone in his academic career. In 1778, Georg was appointed professor for natural history at the Collegium Carolinum in Kassel. And this sets up a repeating pattern for scientists going to the Pacific, writing a book about it, becoming professors. Georg Forster's descriptions, steeped in Enlightenment thinking, entrenched the notion of the Pacific as a utopian paradise and Pacific Islanders as children of nature. He also reported on sexual promiscuity, observing the sailors on the ship and their interaction with indigenous women, and exotic human behavior, which he thought was happening, namely cannibalism. Father and son were also avid, at that point we would call them collectors of cultural artifacts, and today these treasures are part of the Cook Forster collection held by the Institute of Cultural and Social Anthropology at the University of Göttingen, and that's part of their ethnological collection in general. It's considered the world's largest collection of artifacts assembled during the three voyages combined James Cook undertook. And if you're interested in that, you can have a look at the online collection. That's an online exhibition created by a collaboration between the university and the National Museum of Australia, following up on an exhibition in Australia in 2006. But the website is still active and you can still do research there. There are also quite a number of New Zealand treasures represented on this website. However, Germans came to the Pacific not just as whalers, missionaries, and scientists. They also followed their economic interests and established trading posts and plantations on many Pacific islands. The most influential one, the trading house Godefroy & Sohn, Godefroy is probably a name everybody interested in Australian New Zealand history has heard before. Germans, I wouldn't expect so much. This firm went bankrupt in 1878 and was finally dissolved in 1913. It was a longer process of disengagement, so to speak. Johann Caesar Godefroy was born in 1813, and he was the sixth of that name. He came from a long family of traders located in Hamburg since the early 18th century. It's originally a Huguenot family who migrated there in 1837. He became known as the Südseekönig, so the South, or the King of the South Seas, as he was the one responsible for expanding the family trade, first to Cuba and then to Valparaiso, and then later on in 1855 into the Pacific. Eventually, Godefroy, the firm, established 45 offices across Polynesia, Micronesia, and Melanesia. The firm traded in bêche de mer, that's sea cucumber, copra, pearls, mother of pearl, and tortoise shells, which is very common at that point in time. You can make good money selling that to China. The Godefroy shipping line, established in 1850, transported German migrants to southern Africa, Australia, Chile, and California, taking advantage of immigration policies that tried to attract European settlers to these colonies, and also the gold rush in Australia and California at that time, in the middle of the 19th century. By 1870, the company controlled roughly 70% of all South Sea trade and was present on almost every Pacific island through German settlers who acted as middlemen. Its most important trading station, the firm's center of operations, so to speak, in the Pacific, was established on the Samoan island Opolu in the port of Apia in 1857. In 1865, Godefroy acquired land on that island and established coconut plantations to produce copra. And copra is the white dried flesh of coconut, which you can transport much, much better than coconut oil, which is the thing you really want to have, and you distill that later on. By 1872, the company owned roughly 100,000 acres on that island and had expanded into cotton and other cash crops. And to operate these plantations, first, Godefroy organized expeditions into the island's hinterland and coerced indigenous people into work, into indentured servitude, as it was called in that point in time. He then sent out vessels to the Gilbert Islands and the Nomoy Islands, neighboring islands in the Pacific area, exploiting food shortages there to recruit people for their plantations in Samoa. And this is a process called blackbirding. This is unfree labor. This is close to slavery. And this is why I think this image, it's actually a montage done by the German Colonial Society in the 1920s, I assume, to celebrate Godefroy's achievements, depicts Pacific Islanders in this subservient position of collectively being gathered together. Godefroy's activities contributed decisively to the German Empire's active commitment to the acquisition of colonies. As early as 1861, Prussia established a consulate in Apia. In 76, the newly founded German Empire concluded a treaty of friendship with Tonga to build a coal station supplying German vessels in the region with fuel, which was very important strategically also. When Godefroy's firm went bankrupt in 1878, Chancellor Bismarck suggested to transfer all assets into a new company, the Deutsche Handels- und Plantagengesellschaft, it's a German trade and plantation company, which guaranteed continuity of management for and by Godefroy personnel. And in April 88, Bismarck also introduced a bill into parliament, in German that's the Reichstag, that was designed to provide a state guarantee for shareholders who were willing to invest into a Diskontogesellschaft that was created as a go-between, so to speak, which was to take over Godefroy Trading House and thereby securing German economic interests in the Pacific. This initiative was voted down, and Bismarck was a bit discouraged about that. Some historians, such as George Steinmetz and myself, would consider this Samoa bill as the beginning of the official German colonial policy under Bismarck, which is a diversion from traditional historiography you might be familiar with. Traditionally, the hoisting of the flag in Lüderitzbucht, southwest Africa, in August 1884 is seen as the official beginning of political rule, so German political rule. The Pacific is, in looking at the whole of the German colonies established after 1884, Pacific islands obviously are very small, geographically speaking, and also in terms of population. You see that here the numbers of people living in the German colonies, Germans living in the colonies actually is quite a small number. And looking at these colonies, it makes kind of sense that many scholars consider Germany to be only a minor player in Pacific history. The Kaiserreich's presence was limited and did not pursue colonialism actively until the 19th century is the general argument. And you have seen from what I've told you previously, it's a bit more complicated than that. Nevertheless, the Pacific has been for quite a while been quite a blind spot in German historiography on the topic. And this is a map I lifted from the key introduction text into German colonial history at the moment in German-speaking, in German, the Horst Gründer's Geschichte der deutschen Kolonien. We don't have a better introduction at the moment in German. And this is the Pacific. And you can see that Samoa, of all the islands, being such an important place in German colonial history and in Pacific history, is not even on the map. And I think this speaks to the problems German scholars have in dealing with this history. So, historiography. As I said, we have our blind spots here, and I think we can clearly identify them. Today, the history of German imperialism is contested territory. Street names, for instance, commemorating explorers, colonial governors, or colonial territories are being revoked or at least critically discussed. Cultural artifacts acquired by museums and research institutions are under critical scrutiny. The so-called Humboldt Forum, located in the rebuilt Berlin city center, is the epitome of Imperial Prussia, displays the ethnological collections of Africa, Asia, and America, stands at the very center of this debate. The current, at times heated, discussions evolve from an ambivalent post-colonial memory culture. On the one hand, the German colonial project was, for several decades, considered to be of minor significance for the nation's history, rarely taught in school, and often neglected in German historiography apart from very specialized studies. On the other hand, there is, until today, a strong undercurrent of colonial nostalgia in popular culture and family memories, often imagining a special relationship between Germans and indigenous peoples, or picturing German explorers and administrators as benefactors or bringers of modernity. And this is a cover of a book published in the middle of the 1990s, still available today, called Bilder aus dem Paradies, Images from Paradise, depicting Pacific Islanders. And it's going on and on and on and on. However, professional historians are becoming more and more interested in the topic as well, and since the early 2000s, we see a growing number of publications coming out. Most of these studies concentrate on African history, though. However, slowly but steadily, Germany's colonial past in the Pacific also comes into view. And to date, and this is the last slide I'm going to explain, to date, two positions I would claim have emerged that are sharply opposed to each other. One that stresses the process of cultural accommodation on the part of the German colonizers, which then supposedly resulted in a mostly peaceful, even benign colonial rule. The most prominent representative of this view is Hermann Jeri, and you can see his publication here on the left-hand side. And the other position emphasizes the violence and conquest that as inevitable features of colonialism, also in the Pacific. And this rather critical view of German colonialism is reinforced by recent and ongoing research in the field of provenance research. And this is the example I have chosen to show you today. a publication by a well-known and respected historian, Götz Ali, who's actually an expert on Nazi history. And he published this account of the acquisition of an outrigger boat from the island of Louvre by the merchant company Hansheim & Co. in 1903. And he was particularly interested in his great-granduncle, who was a military chaplain, and the role he played in the so-called punitive expeditions that had devastated the Louvre Island in the 1880s and then set up the people in destitution selling this boat to the company. Both positions, accommodation and violence, I would argue, have their merit. Kind of both happened, but in view of Etcheskaya's presentation on colonial racism and continuities into the Nazi era, I'm going to stop here, and I could give you more examples. And I'm looking forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Eva, for your paper. The floor is open for questions or comments.
Thank you, Eva. Part of my tribal history is also Ngāti Awa, which is very closely connected to Te Whakatohia. And we have a different narrative about Volkner.
Yeah.
He was actually beheaded.
Yeah, after he was hanged, I learned. So hanged and then beheaded was what I found.
Yeah.
Beheaded.
Yeah.
At some point.
That's what my understanding is. But thank you. Yeah, very enlightening. I didn't realise how prolific the German people were. I knew in Samoa, and I knew about Volkner, but certainly not the the other processes that were at play during that period of time.
Yeah, that's another... When I learned about, as I said, I learned about Volkner's case when I started preparing this presentation. And I expected that it would be much better remembered in Aotearoa, New Zealand, than it was in Germany. And yeah, I was astounded myself because I didn't know that German missionaries were present in at that point in time in Aotearoa, New Zealand myself. They are kind of everywhere. If you start looking, it's really, thank you.
Thank you very much for this very inspiring talk. I learned a lot. I was wondering about the role of education in German colonialism, because, I mean, it's my field of research, but it's also this conference about what were the German colonies in the Pacific, and how was it linked perhaps also to missionary activities, or was it a different branch of colonialism, let's call it like this. If you could share some more about this, it would be great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a very important point. If I understood you correctly, your question is about education, about colonialism in the 19th century and early 20th century. So today?
Thank you. Sorry, I clarify once more. Education is one tool in colonialism. So I was curious how back then, in the colonial days, education was used as a tool. Not only trade and missionaries and all that. How education was used in that time. If it's of your interest, sorry for the question.
No, it's an important point for the setup of German colonialism proper, so to speak, as soon as it's not just informal colonialism, like with the Godefroys. That's kind of colonialism, but it's not officially state colonialism, partially because there wasn't a German Kaiserreich until 1871. So you have these different nations, these different kingdoms and states that try to do something colonial at various points in time. But since since 1884, education was used by the German colonial state in various capacities and to different degrees, depending on what colony you are looking at. An important distinction is it an exploitative colony, like a plantation colony, like in Cameroon or in German East Africa, today Tanzania, for instance, or Togo, or is it a settler colonial society? A settler colonial society, like the one in Southwest Africa, has a different interest in educating people than a plantation society, so to speak. And according to these different colonial interests, or the different interests of the colonizers, education was used differently. A general rule of thumb is that in German colonies do not educate colonial subjects the way British or French colonizers did. There's no ideal, like with the French, to create a different kind of German people, for instance. The French nation state, especially in Asia, for instance, educated people to make them become Frenchmen and women, just overseas. This was never the German program, so to speak. The program was to educate people to be useful and to be exploited as laborers in different levels. So on the plantation, you don't need education. For some parts of the administration, you need educated people who speak German and can do basic stuff. And that was it. And to a large extent, this task was delegated to missionaries. Missionaries, on the other hand, were a difficult group of people to work with from the perspective of the colonial state, because they had their own agenda and didn't necessarily teach in the language that you wanted them to teach. Some of them taught in English, for instance, because they saw that would be more practical for their people, for the people that they were working with. So it is a big issue. This is a very, very important issue for a number of German colonies, because there are a lot of conflicts arising from that. And I can give you more information on that later on. It's a big issue, really, and missions are crucial in this point.
Yeah. One very short last question.
Sorry.
Otherwise, thank you very much for your talk.